Can you believe Scale is next week? We're almost at conference silly travel season already. How has that happened?
I just started packing my remote broadcasting bag. I'm thinking through this because I'm going to try to do 4 live streams.
Ooh.
Yeah.
The struggle's real. I mean, you know, now I make videos for a living somehow. I've got to pack camera gear and tripods and microphones and all sorts of nonsense. Are we doing a live JB thing whilst we're there?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I want to do a couple. We'll see. I haven't decided what we're doing for Unplugged, but it does happen that Sunday. So I got to figure out something for it.
Yeah.
Soon. I know there's like so much to plan and pack. I can't believe that we're just a few days away from hitting the road. Not ready for it. And then shortly after that, it's Texas Linux Fest and then Linux Fest Northwest. And rumor has it, I may be at Red Hat Summit as well. So a lot of events coming up in a short period of time.
Red Hat Summit, huh? You know, I never got to go to Summit as an employee. I was always a little bit miffed about that. But, you know, such is life.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a good party. The last time I went was just before the IBM acquisition. So it'll be an interesting comparison.
Ah, yes, that's right. Because I just moved here. We just started the show. Yeah, I remember actually thinking I almost made it to that one. But yeah, anyway, that was a long time ago. Joining us on the show today is John Seeger, a VP at Canonical, looks after Juju and a bunch of other infrastructure related stuff. However, we're going to talk to him about Nix primarily today. So if you're into Nix, you will enjoy this interview with John.
Well, John, welcome to the show. And I recall that you work in the Juju and Charms area at Canonical, which I'm vaguely familiar with, but I thought maybe we could start with an explanation of what Juju and Charms are and how people manage infrastructure with them.
Yeah, of course. So Juju is an orchestration tool that is used for deploying all kinds of different workloads on any kind of infrastructure. So it kind of prides itself on being super multi-cloud. So you can deploy to bare metal, to LexD containers, to AWS, to Kubernetes. You can use it to deploy a Kubernetes on AWS. And the way it does that is with packages called charms. So charms are just applications, right? So they're composed of a workload, maybe Postgres, for example, and typically some Python code, which is the charm itself. And that is a pretty simple piece of Python that responds to essentially events that are sent from the controller. So the controller will say, stand up a machine, and then it will feed it a sequence of events like install. And there'll be a callback essentially of the Python code that will then go and install Postgres. It might then send it a configure hook, and there'll be callbacks in there to respond. But the deployment side is kind of the least interesting side. It has this concept called integrations, previously known as relations. And the kind of big thing point about Juju is how to make the integration and operation side much more easy. So I think the deployment of apps is kind of boring, kind of a solved problem. Ansible can do this, Terraform can do this, CloudFormation can do this. We've been deploying apps with code for years, but integration is always really hard. Like you get to the data center, the customer has this thing, you've got this existing Prometheus, you've got this existing database or this old legacy app. How do you tie it all together? And Juju tries to kind of solve that with these integrations. So my role at Canonical is to lead the development of Juju, which is a big Golang project, and then a whole suite of teams who are building kind of first-class operators for Postgres and MySQL and Grafana and Ori and Kubeflow and kind of a huge range of apps.
It's a fascinating product. I think I first ran across it probably Config Management Camp in like 2016, something like that. And Mark,
there's a niche conference.
Yeah, Mark himself was actually talking at the conference about Juju. I think it was quite new back then. But it's one of those projects I've just sort of followed from a distance, and it's certainly got an interesting use case.
It had a rough start. It's been around for about 10 years now, and it's had a very kind of interesting journey. We've really kind of picked up in the last 3 years, really focusing on building the operators that people need to use it, right? So now as a developer, you can turn up, and if you need a really great HA Postgres that knows how to back itself up and can do cross-region replication, you can just get that. You just deploy it and it just does its thing. Previously, those things didn't exist, so you kind of had to invest yourself, but now we are spending the time and effort to do that. So all of the apps that you hopefully would come to your mind will be available.
It's interesting you call them operators, because that word in my mind is inextricably linked to Kubernetes.
Yes.
When I think of an operator, you know, it's kind of like a capturing of operationalizational, God, that's a difficult word to say, isn't it? Knowledge. And, you know, I long ago compared it to like an MSI installer back in the Windows days, where it's a bunch of scripts, it's a bunch of stuff all wrapped up into one that just captures knowledge. Is that a fair comparison to what a Juju operator is?
The term became popularized by Kubernetes, but what's really interesting is that the approach that that kind of captures is exactly what Juju has been doing since 2009. So the way I like to characterize it is, take Postgres as the example again. Imagine going and finding the person who in your circle knows the most about running Postgres in production, proper gnarly Postgres production, right? You know, 10,000 days, lots of backups, lots of replication, lots of connections. Take everything that person knows about running Postgres in production and turn it into really clean, well-tested Python code that anyone can get access to. And so you move from not just having open source application code. We kind of won that fight, right? Postgres, Linux, Grafana, all these amazing applications. There's so much choice. But that doesn't necessarily mean people can actually use it in their environment. So the move of the operators is almost trying to say, okay, we've got the open source apps. Let's go and get open source operations code that lets people actually put it down in their environment and have real faith that it's going to work.
So you're including the batteries in all of these projects, essentially.
Exactly. We are adding the batteries.
Yeah. Okay. So the reason that I actually wanted to talk to you today, forgive me, Gigi's very interesting, but I find Nix at the moment is just all-consuming for me. And you've been all over my various feeds, packaging things for Nix and doing this and doing that. Why do we need Nix if, you know, if we're doing integrations with Juju?
Why do we need Nix? So I got into Nix because I'm just an insufferable Linux desktop nerd, have been for many years. I was a very long time Arch user, sort of 10, 12 years.
By the way.
Yeah, by the way. Nix just kept popping up in places. And I actually tried it about 2-3 years ago and like bounced off it so hard. I was like, don't have the time, ignore. And then about 18 months ago, I had a spare Intel NUC laying around and I kept seeing more and more about it. It was about the time that I moved from Twitter to Mastodon, where things all got a little bit more interesting. And I just gave it a go. And the way I got into it was, you know, I was fortunate enough to have another machine. And so I installed Nix on it. The install process felt pretty familiar to Arch, right? But then did all the usual, like, oh, how do I install something? You can't change the configuration files. And honestly, it was pretty slow, but I watched the Will Taylor Nix videos. I happened across Flakes really early. And so I've only ever really done Flakes. I have very little experience with the older way of doing things. I'm a software engineer by trade, and I think that is kind of quite a nice fit. And yeah, I just built it up. And what I decided was, at the time I was running an Archbox with Sway and a whole bunch of Pipewire, and which at the time was quite bleeding edge. And I basically decided I was going to try and build this box up to be exactly the same as my desktop. And I sort of got there and thought, all right, well, I'll just go all in. Like, I'll just, and I sat here one night, you know, on like a Tuesday evening or something, installed it on my desktop and just like started using it. And from then on, well, now it's on all of my personal machines essentially. And it's even on a machine in my parents-in-law's house running a little Telstra Alexia node for them. I've sort of just completely fallen for it. It feels very difficult to go back for my personal machines.
I agree. I'm definitely at that stage now where family members' computers are all getting Nix. Everything's just getting Nix now, unless it's for a specific project. But I do think a very common bit of feedback we get is, why do I need Nix if I have something like Juju, or why do I need Nix if I have something like Ansible? And it sounds like you're kind of on the school of thought that I have, which is there's room for both. Can you expand on that?
Yes. So I'm definitely sold on the immutable operating system for a workstation or a bunch of servers you kind of manage more in the kind of sysadmin-y way, more in like, here's my collection of my machines that I look after and that I shepherd. I'm absolutely certain that using Nix to do things like building containers, right? Building OCF Docker containers is a good idea. I do this myself. My blog is a Docker container built with Nix, shipped off to fly.io, and that's how I host it. I'm less convinced in big enterprise deployments of lots of HANUS. Now, maybe I don't have the skills yet. Like, you still need something to sit in the middle and coordinate all of that, right? So at the simplistic end, you've got people punching commands into keyboards and pressing enter with their SSH keys. You can level that up a bit. There are things like DeployRS and Colmena and other deployment frameworks, which you can power with CI, right? Like you write your Nix flake, you run the checks, you commit it into a Git repository, and a CI runner picks that up and deploys it. That works for simple things. That would work for my lab. I don't think that would necessarily work in JP Morgan, where they've got 15 different Postgres databases, they have enterprise identity going on. They don't necessarily have the engineers to troubleshoot the fact that something's missing a library, do you know what I mean? Because it hasn't been patched properly. I don't know.
You know, this has been the case for many tools over the years, but I think with Nix in particular, it is, I don't want to say a problem, because it's not. It's just a fact, a truth, that there are multiple different ways to solve every single problem. And I look at your flake, John, and I look at, you know, Mitchell Hashimoto's flake, and then I look at mine, and they're all solving similar problem, like Wimpy's flake. They're all solving the same problem in different way, like totally different ways.
It's super hard to get yourself in trouble. I worked with this Italian fellow who was a bit of a like an observability ninja for a little while. And he had this phrase, which I think is so apt. He was like, it's like radioactive Lego. It's super fun to play with, but there might be consequences, right? I'm sure there are people doing Nix at scale, but for me, I haven't yet grokked how you would really pull that off at like as a big operation.
Nix at the moment for me is all consuming, but I do find myself yak shaving quite often with it. Like I think to myself, okay, a good example, Plasma 6 came out this week and I thought I would like to try Plasma 6 on my framework. Oh, look at that. There's one line in my config of services.plasma5.enable. I'm just going to rev that to say Plasma 6, rebuild. Oh, wait, no, services is a custom keyword within Nix configuration and I need to now not only rebase my entire framework configuration off of unstable and rebuild the whole thing, but I can't just do an overlay for one specific module without an awful lot of spelunking into the inner workings of how the module's system works. Little things like that are rough edges that we're making excuses for computers with by saying, oh, you just disabled the module and then you just import this and do that and do the other. Right? It's not straightforward. It should honestly just be like the whole 2311 unstable versus like it's just confusing. And I'd love to get, particularly given the fact you've been doing so much packaging lately, get your take on that whole kind of Nix consumability thing.
The learning curve is tough. I first tried to do it by just sitting down and like grizzing through it, basically. Like I'm a developer. I'm like, how can it be? I'm a developer. I'm a long-term, you know, Linux user. I'm pretty comfortable with the command line. I'm, feel like I've been there. And I sat down and I just didn't get it.
Yeah.
And so the approach I took was to go back and say like, okay, well, let's first understand the Nix language. Let's understand the syntax. So when I read something, I know what's actually going on. Then I sort of started to read a bit about, you know, how the store is structured and I just sort of slowly built up like that. It is tough. And actually, I think packaging is tough. I mean, part of my role at Canonical is to look after Snapcraft, which is the tool for building snaps, right? And in fact, I package Snapcraft for Nix in a weird turn of events. It's similar, right? Like people look at it and go, whoa, this is hard. And in reality, like we're building a whole set of patterns which translate across building containers and snaps and charms and all kinds of things. But it is hard. Like packaging, I think the setup of the crafts now is really, really elegant. You still have to learn it, right? It still has its idiosyncrasies. You're still talking about taking a package, compiling it potentially in some kind of weird prefix. You might have to patch the location of a bunch of libraries. You have to create something that's going to launch it and manage it. Like it is quite hard, right? I don't see them necessarily as comparable, but I remember going through the experience of learning how to write sort of more complicated snaps and a similar feeling of like, okay, this is complicated. And it's the same if you actually try to build a dev package that adheres to Debian policy, right? Like it's a fine art. It's not just something, not anyone can just yeet a dev together and get it accepted into Debian, right? It's just not that simple.
I would say that's a feature, to be honest with you. Otherwise, the quality just wouldn't be there.
I have spoken with individuals that would probably be familiar with people using Nix at scale, and they really are taking more of a flake-based approach to managing software. They're not really dealing with the software channels or release channels. You know, they're really focused on just deploying software through flakes. And I think that's something that FlakeHub is also hoping to help manage. You know, one of the things that I've learned to appreciate is they have a shared namespace where you can actually set up ACLs and all of this stuff for people using it at scale. So that kind of stuff's being built out right now, you know, but I think your criticism's fair. You know, your example of like, you know, managing 10 or 50 different Postgres databases on different systems throughout the company where you got different departments and divisions. Like, it is really not quite there yet. And that's an area where existing products are really focused on for decades. But we already see the tooling getting built.
Yeah, I think the potential is there, right? But, you know, if you're a boutique software house with 10, 15, 20, you know, 100 super enthusiastic, bright folks, I'm absolutely certain you could make it work and build something we'd all be very envious of.
Yeah, or a home lab, and I think is another, or for, you know, for us here at JB, we've got a dozen servers.
What a great use case, right? You solve a whole bunch of niche stuff with Jack and Pipewire and never have to solve it again, right? Like, problem solved. The other thing to think about, like if I think about it, you know, in my personal life, it's Nix all the way. In my work life, I clearly do the Ubuntu thing pretty often. If you think about it from like a supportability perspective, and, you know, I have a lot of confidence in a lot of the folks who maintain NixOS. I don't have a strong view on what the security story is, but I know how much of an effort that is at Canonical. Like, I know how much time and money and resource it takes to pull off what they pull off. And so I think it has the potential. I think the approach is super interesting, but it is like, you've got to really want to know it before you're going to get competent at it, right?
So speaking of, you know, taking things forward, I noticed that you packaged Scrutiny, the hard disk smart monitoring tool that we talked about. It was funny on Mastodon. You were like, in a recent episode of Self-Hosted, and I messaged you back and said, yeah, that was like 3 years ago, dude.
You definitely mentioned it in a recent show. It came back on my radar maybe end of last year. I don't know.
Probably. I found this particular app pretty interesting, though, because it just so happened that week as well, I'd gone through my first contribution to Nix packages, doing a very basic Go app, nothing quite on the scale of Scrutiny. Why don't you talk us through the process of contributing to Nix packages?
Yeah, actually, this is one of the things that got me super hooked on Nix, is the ability for people to show up and contribute and get reviews and actually become a contributor. Like, you can contribute to an operating system with relatively little experience, with almost no barrier. One Git repository full of text files, you make a pull request, you ask some help, people will give you a bunch of reviews and you can land it. And that really, for me, just captured me in terms of like, oh wow, not only can I make all these local additions, I can actually get this stuff landed. So Scrutiny was about my third or fourth kind of package or module, some combination. It looks a little bit more complicated, but in reality, it's two Go binaries, one of which has a Node.js front end embedded into it. So it's two packages. The module system, you know, takes a bit of getting used to, but fundamentally you give the user a set of options and that generates a set of config, and the config is users, systemd units, that sort of thing. The thing that I love, one of the things I think is super powerful, is the test framework. It's really, really interesting, like the tooling to spin up virtual machines with different configurations and assert against the state of that machine using something convenient like Python, I think is super interesting, right? Like, that's a battle that traditional Linux operating systems have been fighting for many years, right? Like, how do you do integration testing of all of these packages and all of these configurations? And Nix is doing that with the test suite, and they're slowly getting to more and more coverage, and they can test some really complex kind of combinations of different things on a system because of it.
Their GitHub Action sort of CI pipeline is absolute beast mode on that thing.
Yeah,
like, you open a PR and it's hours. I mean, the initial tests happen pretty fast, but like for the full test suite to run, it takes several hours.
What I like about it is because of the kind of ethos of it and the fact that it's, you can build it all from source and it's all reproducible. Like, to get that, like, if you want to run the integration test for Scrutiny on your machine, you can do that. Like, super simple, one command, right? Like, git clone, build the Nixos test for Scrutiny, and you're away. And you can, and that to me, again, was something that really captured me, was this, it felt so hackable. It's like, okay, there's loads of them, but it's still just a pile of text files, right?
I think for me, the one that got me was the build Go module sort of wrapper, like a helper. I don't know what to call it, really. I don't know much about building Go applications. And the app that I picked to package was Figurine, just like a little, it's like a message of the day, like just prints out text, colorful, written in Go. Nothing too clever. So certainly not as good as Scrutiny with, you know, a database and all that kind of stuff underneath and a collector and all the rest of it. But I noticed that you use build Go module in your build as well. And I wondered if there are any tips, tricks, anything like that?
I think the tips and tricks are, and I learned a few of them on the way through, like part of the reason I publicized it was because of, I think it highlights what an opportunity it is to learn by going through the process, right? I think the helpers in Nix are really great. You've got the kind of cargo package one, the Go module, there's ones for building node packages. And what I would try, what I would probably say is like, wherever possible, stick to the kind of supported way through. Like it'll have a predefined patch phase, build phase, install phase, check phase. And you can override them. You'll see various people saying, you know, defining their own install phase. I've done that a bunch of times. I did it on Scrutiny the first time round. And then kind of as I went through and read the docs more and more deeply, started to understand that a lot of it was already catered for and I didn't need to kind of do that overriding. So I would say, yeah, the docs are a little terse at times, I think it's safe to say.
Safe to say.
But I also, one of the tricks I do is I just do lots of searching. So for example, GitHub's new code search I find pretty handy. So you browse to the Nix packages repository, like hit the /key and type build go module. And just take a look at 10, 15 examples and see how other people have solved the same problems. With, you know, 80 something thousand packages, you're unlikely to be the first person with that problem is kind of how I look at it.
Unless, as it turns out, you want to run Image. I was looking the other day, you know, the self-hosted photo backup.
Yes.
Image.
Yes.
Apparently, there's a whole bunch of upstream dependencies for that particular application, which aren't yet in Nix. And there's a whole thread about it. I'll put a link to that and all of John's blog posts in the show notes. I wrote one as well about my adventures packaging for Nix. We'll also put a link in the show notes to an hour-long chat that I saw John had with Victor Peterson over on YouTube, talking about a lot more of the intricacies of Nix and the sort of general ethos about, you know, why an Ubuntu guy is using Nix in the first place. And it also struck me during that interview that even the Linux guys, the guys building Canonical software and, dare I say, Linux tools for people, even they're starting to get sucked into the Nix vortex.
Yeah, so Victor I met through Canonical. Victor runs a company called Screenly, which is a digital signage company. Super interesting, all runs on Ubuntu Core. And I did this episode with him. He's been interested in Nix for a little while. And I did the episode to kind of having just packaged their CLI tool for Nix packages. He was interested in that. And so it's exactly that. It's a deep dive into what Nix is as a language, as a package manager, and as an operating system, and then a bit of some questions on reproducibility and how it can be used. One thing it does highlight, though, which is really interesting, is you guys will definitely be familiar with Ubuntu Core, our immutable offering. And one of the really interesting things about the immutable distro scene at the moment is nearly all of them rely upon some kind of file system fanciness for immutability, butterfs, some kind of AB root. Ubuntu Core and Nix are the two closest going. If you think about the way they work, right? Like they literally just swap out a kernel and it points at a different path to the system, a different revision of the snap. It's actually, there's a surprising amount of similarity. I wouldn't call them the same, but it's interesting how similar they are by comparison to something like Silverblue, for example.
That's a great point. That is, I was getting to that conclusion, but I hadn't put it all together. That is a very good point. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us. It was a great chat, and keep up the great work.
Been busy on the old YouTubes the last couple of weeks. A couple of videos that folks have been... I always wonder when people are like, oh, I've had loads of people ask me about this. Like, how many people is loads? I had probably a dozen people saying, when are you going to get to this server build, Alex? So for me, I've had a few people asking about it, and I have built myself the epic... I feel like I want to be in Sparta right now. This is epic. This is Sparta. Epic Rome home server. The specs on this thing are, frankly, kind of bonkers. It's an AMD EPYC 7402 CPU, 24 cores, 48 threads, 256 gigs of ECC memory, coupled with goodness knows how many NVMe SSDs, a couple of U.2 NVMe drives as well, a couple of graphics cards. I had a listener actually sell me their Arc Pro A40 single slot OEM only graphics card so that I could actually do quick sync on this thing as well.
Slick get. That's perfect.
Well, yeah, my currency now with this motherboard because, okay, let me set the scene. Okay, so for the last few years, my media server has been an i5-8500-based system, and I've actually kind of been proud that my main server CPU is from, like, 2019, 2018. Like, it's a fairly old boy, right? but it doesn't have very many PCIe lanes. And about a year ago, when I upgraded all of my home networking to 10 gig, I really started to feel that problem quite acutely on that box, because that motherboard that I have in the i5 system is an ASRock rack motherboard, which I've talked about in the show before. There's a link on my blog, which will be in the link, which will be in the show notes down below too. But the issue with that CPU is Intel consumer CPUs don't expose very many PCIe lanes. The CPU itself gets, I think, 16, and then the chipset gets another 20 or so. And by the time you've taken care of things like the IPMI, the built-in BMC chip, having some PCIe lanes, and then the SATA controller, and then the onboard NICs and that kind of stuff, it doesn't leave a huge number of lanes left for actual peripherals, like an SFP plus 10 gig networking card. And so what happens is, to kind of work around that, ASRock rack put inside the motherboard PCIe switches. And so when you put a 16X card into your 16X slot, and you also put another card into the third slot on that motherboard, the PCIe switch engages, and suddenly your 16X slot becomes 2 8 slots. And so you can only run an 8X PCIe card in there, which doesn't sound too bad, except I was trying to run one of those fancy M.2 cards that splits four M.2 devices across a single slot using bifurcation.
Of course.
And so, you know, I've limped along for the last year, poor old Alex, with a single NVMe drive for my download unpacking. That's what I end up having to need the most IOPS for, is when I'm downloading stuff at gigabit speed, unpacking all those files. And like, it's pretty tough on the disk, actually. And so I've limped along for a year with that being the case. But finally, with this Epic system, I've gone up from, what was that, 16 plus 20 lanes. I've gone up to 128 PCIe lanes directly into the CPU. No chipsets, no Northbridge, Southbridge nonsense, just 128 direct wired PCIe Gen 4 lanes, no less. So I've got bandwidth for days. I've got PCIe slots for days. I've got on this new motherboard, it's a Supermicro H12 SSL-i motherboard. I've got five 16X PCIe slots and two 8X PCIe slots. On top of that, there are a pair of M.2 NVMe slots on the motherboard itself, each of which have four PCIe lanes to boot as well. And it's got a built-in LSI SAS controller built directly into the motherboard as well. Like, it's just completely bonkers and overkill in all the best kinds of ways.
In all the ways you need and want, right? Now, what about noise, you know, these types of things? Like the quality of life things.
That's not too bad. I mean, so Sliger are a case manufacturer that saw my Homelab 15 review and were kind enough to send me over another case. So I've now got three home server cases in the house. This is actually quite a nice unit, the CX4712. It takes 10 3.5-inch spinning hard drives, and it's also got a pair of 5.25-inch drive bays in the front as well. So I bought a 6-in-1 2.5-inch SSD slot-loading, you know, tray-based system, hot swap system, to go in the front of my Sliger case. So I've got room for, well, potentially 12 SSDs. I'm only using 3 or 4 of them right now, but I'm only using 3 or 4 of them right now, but you know, it's
You got some room to grow.
Exactly. And that really was the motivation for this entire build, to be honest with you. I've been doing a lot more virtualization for work lately. You know, I'm trying to build out entire demo environments for YouTube videos where I've got 3 or 4 machines on a separate VLAN for one video and the same for another video. And like, I'm building out these complete fake environments as if you're building real infrastructure. Like, I'm building out a whole server over here and then a desktop over there and a little Caddy reverse proxy over here. And like, running out of PCIe lanes is one thing, but running out of RAM is another. Like, the i5 can only really support about 64 gigs of memory. I mean, some people put 128 in there, but it's not the most stable in my experience. So I kind of stuck at 64. This new build, 256 gigs. I've got RAM to last me for days. And if I wanted to, I could double it to 512 with no problem.
Wow. Well, I look forward to buying that from you used after a few years.
Well, yeah, speaking of buying it, the price is something that's worth talking about because...
Oh, yeah, sure.
It brand new, these things were just out of the reach of most home labbers, to be honest with you. But, you know, if you start looking at the fact at what this system can do for me, and I'm replacing three or four systems in this house with just one box, it makes the price a little bit easier to swallow. I'm sort of dancing around it here because it's a big number. It was $1,750 for the motherboard, the CPU, the RAM, and a CPU cooler as well.
Not including disk then?
No disks, not including disks because, well, I frankly don't want to add up how much I've spent on hard drives over the years. And the Slyger case, if I had purchased that, would have been another $400. So very quickly, you're sort of adding up to well over $2,000.
So you'd want to build this for something that could last 4 or 5 years at least, maybe more.
Yeah. And that's kind of the interesting thing for me. Like if you compare this build and this case directly to the Homelab 15, right? And their price tag of $2,000, give or take, for the full build. I'm gonna just say that they're both about $2,000 because prices fluctuate, all that kind of stuff. What's interesting is that the HL15 was a brand new build. So brand new parts, brand new Supermicro motherboard, you know, so you get warranty. The parts that I purchased, the Epic parts, were from a Chinese eBay seller called TUGM something or other. There'll be a link to my YouTube video in which there's a link in the description to all of the components and all the rest of it for you to have a browse for. So, you know, it's not quite a direct comparison, you know, comparing a brand new product to used, you know, enterprise gear. But the reality is, one of the things we do in Homelab world the best, I think, is actually give these old servers a new lease of life. And is it the most responsible thing in the world to buy a brand new system, particularly with the 45 dry system, when the Xeon they send out with it, the 6-core Xeon, is it's kind of slow and not, you know, not the best CPU. I mean, yes, you can upgrade it, but that's extra cost. That's, you know, so I look at the two servers at, you know, the $2,000-ish price point, and well, there's no comparison.
Yeah, and I wonder if the audience feels like $2,000 is too much for a Homelab box. I mean, I grant not everybody, but I wonder, as you look at trying to build something that would last you 2 to 4 to 5 years, and I look at my storage consumption rate, and I look at all of the applications I want, like I want to get Frigate going in the future. I want to get more local AI running, both for myself at home. My wife likes it for asking gardening questions, and I want it here for summarizing JB show notes and chapters so we can inevitably have some sort of system where internally we can say, in what show did Alex and I talk about his epic server build? And, you know, you just query the system and it can tell us that. And yep. I want to experiment with those things internally. And I just, all of these things are adding cost pressure and resource pressure. And I feel like maybe $2,000 these days, assuming one can afford it, is not unreasonable for a performance server that will have runway for multiple years. I mean, you're talking, you've got a system here where you can put in a lot more drives. You can offload some of the tasks to that ARC card, which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a system that's going to be hard to beat for a couple of years minimum, and then it's still going to work great for years after that. So I wonder, just my question is to the audience, boost in or go to the contact page, what is your price point for a Homelab server? I don't think we've ever asked the audience. I know it's not exactly something people like to talk about, but I'm really curious because I think I'm not that I could necessarily buy it right now and pull the trigger, but I think I'm in the camp of $2,000 for something that could have a lot of storage and some performance is pretty reasonable these days.
I mean, if you look at it, the big advancement between the two systems, my old i5 system and this one, is it's consumer grade versus server grade stuff.
Right.
The currency that I now deal in is PCIe slots rather than PCIe lanes. And just, you know, I've got 7 single slot cards I could essentially fit into that system. So if you were, for example, to take a look at the NVIDIA RTX A4000, that is a single slot PCIe card that takes a single 6-pin power cable. So it's roughly 150 watts plus the 75-ish it pulls from the socket itself. And I could essentially have 5 of those things in this box. First of all, that's a lot of heat to deal with, but that's a separate problem. But, you know, rather than buying a 3080 or something like that that's got a 2 or a 2.5 slot cooler, it's much more cost effective for doing these sort of machine learning AI type workloads. And I will be experimenting with Ollama over the coming weeks, in particular locally with a lot of this self-hosted LLM stuff, using an A4000, which I've got in the system as well. And it's, you know, it's fascinating. Like you say, like, there's so much happening in the AI space at the moment that it almost behooves you to have a card like that in a system that you can have access to. Because I tried to run some of these models just CPU only, and then I threw it on the NVIDIA card, and I went, oh, I see now.
The other reality of the distribution of these AI projects right now is most of the time they're distributed as a container, sometimes as a setup script, and they expect a video card. And I'm always doing the math. Like, should I do this one locally on my laptop, or should I download this one and run this one on the server because it's going to use a web UI and we'd all like to have access to it? And I'm constantly trying to just do that math. And I think it makes a lot of sense to have one rig where I actually just would have that investment, have that setup. And because like 90% of these things are just web front ends, that's how you get the results. It makes a lot of sense to have one box. And then me, of course, I'd throw that app on my tailnet, right? So then these AI services would just be put the name into your browser on every machine and they just pop right up. And having one box that has the hardware capabilities for me, you know, a couple of people, and, you know, maybe us here at JB, seems like the way to go instead of all individual machines all having to have that power.
Right. And power is going to be my next little topic here, actually. If I asked you how much you thought a 24-core monster CPU with half a, you know, quarter of a terabyte of RAM in it, how much are idle? Just CPU, motherboard, no PCIe devices. What would be an acceptable idle power draw for you?
Me? Well, that's different. But, I mean, you got to figure. For most people, I think it's something in the light bulb, 60, 70 watts, 80 watts would be fine. You know, we see some light bulbs, maybe 110 watts for, I don't know.
Because, I mean, if you go back a couple of generations to the LGA 2011 build that I had before this, which was several years ago now, but it was a dual Xeon chip. And I had, I think, spread across two CPUs, I had 20 cores and 40 threads and 128 gigs of RAM when I was doing all that OpenShift stuff for Red Hat. This Epic system, from the wall, 45 to 50 watts at idle.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I think my servers are hundreds of watts.
Well, I'm used to those Xeons, and they were in the 150 to 200 watt range.
Yeah.
Sat there doing Billy Bob nothing at all, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what mine is. That is really a huge change.
Big difference.
Yeah, boy, I'm glad to hear that.
And then you add in the Arc Pro card. I mean, I go through all the specifics in the video, but the Arc Pro card was about 10 watts at idle. The NVIDIA card was about 10 watts. The 10 gig networking SFP Plus card was about 10 watts. By the time you add in all hard drives, you know, 3.5-inch hard drives, that's sort of another 60 watts, give or take 5 or 6 watts each. You know, so I've got this whole super powerful box running in the basement for 175 watts. I mean, it just absolutely blows my mind that I can have that much power at my disposal for such a small power budget.
Yeah, that's a big, big improvement. And yeah, you're right. It would run circles around my system. That's good. I'm really glad to hear that. It makes me kind of think this is a future direction for maybe systems here at the JB headquarters.
The only thing really that would run circles around it in terms of power usage would be like a fleet of, you know, small form factor PCs or something like that.
Sure, sure.
But then you've got the complexity of managing 10 or 15 different power supplies and all the overhead of managing 10 or 15 different operating systems and yada, 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 right? You get the idea.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Beowulf cluster is not always the answer anymore. But I really, you know, because as I've been looking at this, I'm thinking, what are we going to do? Are we going to put video cards in several of our machines and buy several video cards? That's just not very realistic from a budget standpoint.
No.
And I don't necessarily need that. And am I going to buy all my future laptops with dedicated graphics, or only buy Macs with neural cores? I just don't think that's viable either. I'd like to have my laptops be lean, mean, and portable. So yeah, I think this is fantastic, Alex. This is a pretty epic build.
I see what you did there. Well, Kevin writes in, do you have any advice or suggestions for managing a huge Docker Compose file beyond just splitting it into smaller chunks? I do, actually. Yes, for several years now, I have used a Ansible-based Docker Compose generated. There'll be a link to it in the show notes down below. But more recently, I've actually taken not only to using the VS Code Remote SSH plugin to manage Docker Compose files on my remote systems, but also the Tailscale plugin for VS Code is pretty handy to just drop in, you know, particularly in those demo environments that I'm building all the time, where I'm constantly just tweaking paths and settings and lots of little small tweaks and that kind of stuff. And then as I kind of productionize stuff and put it into my pseudo prod that's in my basement, you know, we all have that, I'm sure, listening to this show. Then I put it through the Ansible Ringer and put it into the Docker Compose generator, which essentially just takes as an input a YAML dictionary of values, and then using Jinja 2 templating under the hood, spits out a formatted Docker Compose file.
I went the route of kind of going in between, Kevin, and this is sort of the low tech, is I decided to split Docker Composes into general services group. So I have like a media Docker Compose, and I have my notes and VS Code server and a few other things are kind of in that category. And then I also have like PyHole separate and stuff like that. And then what I do is just go into each individual category as its own individual server on the or file. And then what I do is I just go into each directory where I have that individual stack's Docker Compose, and I will just update those. And you could obviously do this a lot of different ways, but for me, instead of creating like 15 different Docker Composes, it means I have 4 different Docker Composes, and it's just broken down by category. But I'd love to hear other people's ideas.
Feature request for Docker Compose for me would be some kind of higher level orchestration of those. I think they call them stacks underneath. It'd be great if I could just, you know, sit at my top level containers directory and have within it multiple, you know, media servers, administration, all that kind of other stuff, you know, and underneath as a separate directories with their own, you know, little fiefdoms within them. But then at that higher level, if I could just type something like Docker Compose, I don't know, stop all or something, and it would just traverse all of the Docker Compose files underneath, merge them into one massive file for me whenever I do that. So I can act on all the containers on my system all at once. That's the reason I've stuck with a single monolithic file broken up with Ansible underneath.
Yeah, from your lips to some developer's ears.
I hope so.
Maybe somebody knows how to do it and they can boost it in. We got some great boosts this week, and Aaron is our baller with 78,000. Six sats, and he was following up on a boost from our previous episode. He said I got the pronunciation wrong of his town in Texas. Surprise, surprise.
Shocker.
It's cute, too. It's called Bernie, the town of Bernie. I you know what? Bernie, where are you from? Bernie, Texas. Bernie. Yeah, Bernie. I would love that. I would love to be able to say that. He says, sorry about the confusion. No, it was all my fault. It's an area of Texas that has German heritage. He said, you'd be surprised about Thai food here in Texas, too. I doubt that. You see, that's what somebody who's lived in Texas says about Texas Thai food.
If you've ever been to the Pacific Northwest, you'll understand the Pacific Rim is obviously where a lot of Asians land first. And so the food from Asia in the Pacific Rim, some of the best Thai food I've ever had has been in the Seattle general area.
Top-notch primo.
Yeah.
Top-notch primo.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. But he says they'd blow you away. So I'd be down to try it. Plus, I want to go to a town called Bernie anyways.
And hey, I used to think that barbecue I used to get in London was good until I went to Austin. So
I know,
you know,
that actually wrecked me. I can confidently say that I have never had barbecue as good since. And it kind of wrecked me. And the local places around here very much disappoint. And I, much like you just mentioned, did not appreciate that. And I kind of wish in a way I didn't know.
Yeah.
But much like it probably did for you, it's kind of inspired me to maybe this summer really get into actually just making my own brisket again. Sometimes you got to do it yourself.
Now I'm hungry. Thanks, Chris.
I know, right? He says, yeah, it's lunchtime. He says, he finishes with, he appreciated the advice with Jellyfin over Tailscale. Yeah. You know, Tailscale and all of my services are like peanut butter and jelly. But the Jellyfin one solved sharing for me. I don't share it with as many people anymore, but my wife and I rarely these days, but every now and then there's this little burger place that's in like a train car, and they make some of the best burgers around, and we like to go out there and order, but sometimes it can take them a bit, and it's a great chance to watch an episode of like Who's the Boss or, you know, something like that, maybe King of the Hill. And those are great shows because they're low res and they're easy to stream over cellular. And I was never – when we switched to Jellyfin, I'd lost that. And then when I realized, hey, dummy, put it all on Tailscale. problem solved. Now we get to watch King of the Hill at the Burger Place.
Well, dare I say, keep an eye out on the Tailscale channels this week, maybe next week. I've got a video planned talking about how to do sharing of self-hosted services using custom domains, using Kaddy underneath. So
cool.
If you don't want to rely on the TS.net stuff, that's your solution.
Odin's Ride comes in with 5,000 sats. I said I was glad to hear a bit about Unraid on the show. As a fully capable sysadmin, I've been a long-time happy Unraid user simply because it makes things so simple. It's a great solution for those of us who want to self-host but are just too busy to keep up with the nitty-gritty technical details or don't want to spend a ton of time maintaining systems. Plus, it works great with Tailscale. I'm feeling this one, Odin. My shame right now is my home assistant has gone kind of sideways on me in a weird way. Just certain things aren't working. I, for years, have used bedtime and good morning scripts, and it's, you know, I have it tied to buttons. It's a button on the dashboard. They just quit working, and I haven't touched the system for something like nearly 50 days. I haven't, and this is part of the reason why things have gone sideways. I haven't done any updates. I haven't changed any configuration. I literally have. I've only rebooted it a couple of times, and things are just kind of not working. And I don't know if it's a bug or what. And I feel this right now. Like, I really haven't had time to get to my infrastructure. I've been so busy. And I'm only going to be busier with this travel season. Could really use something that just is an easy button for a little while. I wish I could just hit a button and everything is just fully self-automated for a while.
That's the dream.
BirdDad0234 comes in with 10,000 sats. He'll be our last booster this week. And he says, I've been meaning to send this in so many times. To heal your ripping woes, I present ARM. The automatic ripping machine. Insert a disc, it finds it, and then it rips it appropriately. Go forth and rip, my dudes.
Oh, so you mean my Windows Media Center, or Windows Media Player ripping wasn't the best way to do something?
Might be a step up, Alex. This might be a step up.
Likely.
So you just insert a Blu-ray, a DVD, or a music CD. It checks to see if it's audio, video, or whatever, and data, and then it just rips it. Man, just put a little Linux box somewhere with a drive?
It just does it. It goes all Shia LaBeouf and just does it. Huh?
That's awesome. Yeah, just do it.
Nice.
Thank you, everybody who boosted. And we had 6 boosters. We only stacked 98,228 sats, though. I think maybe that's in a commentary on last episode. But we still appreciate everybody who did boost in. You can get a new podcast app and join the Podcasting 2.0 revolution that is working to keep podcasting decentralized and making it possible for the audience to fund the podcast directly, keeping you the biggest customer and therefore the focus on the quality. Podcastapps.com, and also a big thank you to our SREs.
Don't forget, with conference season fast approaching, meetup.com/JupiterBroadcasting is the place to go to find out all of the real-time information about all the meetups that we're having. There'll also be various matrix rooms generally related to each event as well. So if you want to find out more information about that, meetup.com/JupiterBroadcasting.
Yes, coming up very soon. Even if you can't see us at Scale, we'll have a couple events shortly after that, so maybe we'll get a chance to say hi. You can find me on Weapon X. I am at Chris LAS.
Still doing the Weapon X thing, huh?
As long as it's got that stupid name.
I'm over at alex.ktz.me for all the various places that I'm on the internet. And thanks for listening, everybody. That was selfhosted.show/118.
As we record, we got a fresh Home Assistant 24.3, and their headline is Drag and Drop Like It's Hot, a new experimental drag and drop feature so you can move things around.
Finally.
New layout section called Sections.
Oh, yeah.
For the dashboard.
That's the good stuff.
You were actually just asking for UI fixes, remember?
Oh, yeah.
They were listening.
Good. You're getting it. Yes, all sorts of various things. You know, I kind of forget that Home Assistant is so integral to my world. And then during the server rebuild that happened over the last couple of weeks, I actually took every single server in the house offline for about 8 hours. I pulled out SSDs out of systems and made sure that all the firmwares had been updated and all that kind of stuff. And one of them was my DNS box, which is also running Home Assistant.
Mm.
You know, it got to a certain time of day and the lights didn't turn on. And I'm like, oh. And then I realized that my heating hadn't actually turned itself back down to a correct level. And then I realized that the automatic blinds hadn't closed. And then it went on and on and on. It's just one of those projects that just keeps giving. And it's hard to say enough good things about it in general.
Oh, they have this new grouping and section stuff that aligns really nicely and kind of brings related things together. And it looks like they have a new way they're displaying the map for location stuff. I mean, the drag and drop and rearrangement of cards and sections is going to be huge for users. I know they have tried to take cracks at this before.
Do you use the mapping function much? I feel like it's something that I should use, but I don't.
I don't a lot. I have used it a little bit more once I created a dashboard that specifically is a dashboard of my location and my wife's location, both visually and the address. Because when I switched to a Pixel, the first thing she said to me was, you know, I really like to have some sort of Find My solution for you.
Yep.
And because we use that a fair amount. And then the first question was, well, how do I implement a Find My iPhone type solution that isn't just going to be a massive privacy leak, which was the big motivation to switch to the Pixel in the first place.
Indeed. Yeah.
And so I thought about running own tracks and I thought about all these different solutions. And then ultimately it dawned on me that if I just turned up the precision accuracy, actually Home Assistant basically works. I don't know if it's quite as real time as Find My, but you know, we don't quite need that. So it works.
You know, the real issue with, I think, a lot of the location tracking and stuff like that is it's all based off specific devices. And so every time you change your phone, you have to remember to go in and change that's the device that's being tracked.
Yes, yes, yes. Very much that. And the other problem is you can sometimes leave devices behind. So you need like some sort of probability score where if you had all your devices in there and two of three are gone, then it's probable you're not home. You know, because this can all get – all of my automations get completely destroyed if my wife forgets her phone. Right?
Yep.
But she generally never forgets her watch because it's attached to her arm or whatever it might be.
But if she forgets her arm, we've got bigger problems.
Yeah. One of the things that I do find to also kind of be useful for that is pulling in the SSID that they're connected to as a good data point. And then, you know, with Home Assistant too, it knows when you're driving, if depending on what the data you share, so you can be in driving mode, which is also kind of useful. So but you have to stack all that yourself. And I just really can only be bothered to set something up like that once, maybe.
Yeah, I think in general, just the entropy of a Home Assistant install, as you say, you don't touch it for 6 weeks and things start going sideways.
Yeah, the scripts thing is the oddest thing to break because that was one of the very first things I've ever set up. I've used it literally every night for years, and then it just stopped working recently. No new devices or nothing. I mean, just because I've been so busy. That's an odd one and a little concerning, and I don't even know how to troubleshoot that.
Yeah, that is a weird one. I found an interesting thing for Home Assistant this week. I don't know how finished it is, but they're putting this particular project, there'll be a link in the show notes, is putting Olama integration into Home Assistant. The issue with that, though, is that Olama doesn't present an open API compatible API.
Mm-hmm.
Not open AI compatible API.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Too many TLAs. And so this project tries to act as like a go-between the two, like translates the Olama calls into open AI compatible ones. Pretty interesting stuff, because then if I can fully self-host the assist thing that's in my house, backed by a full speed, like Olama GPU backed, like if Olama can just be my AI core of choice, and then I can start throwing all sorts of different tasks at it from anywhere.
Yeah, with this API compatibility layer, you could.
Yeah, that's the dream really for me.
Right.
I don't think it's quite there yet, but certainly I'm going to be keeping an eye on that one.
Yeah, that'll be fascinating. That's a good one to integrate. Two last things I just want to mention about Home Assistant before we
wrap
up for the night. They've revamped the energy graph, which I actually use now that I've connected it to my Victron system. I actually use the energy system because I have all the data. And I like it. I like the look of it a lot. And then the other thing I thought, speaking of scripts, that was interesting is they've added a capture sequence of actions to generate a script. So I guess you can put it in like some sort of – obviously, I haven't installed this yet. But you essentially put it in some sort of record mode and you go through a sequence of actions and it just – converts that into a script that it can run for you in the future. And then, you know, you can put in variables in there, you know, allowing you to put different data types in there when the script runs so you can insert, you know, present information. That's a neat new feature that I'm probably going to be playing with.
I watch a lot of the guys on YouTube playing with the script stuff like that, and I just think, oh, I wish I had the time.
I know.
I wish I had the time to do that.
I fantasize about driving the RV somewhere with no internet connectivity for a couple of days. And just working on stuff like that, you know, just taking a few resources with me, save them offline, and just work on that. But in reality, you probably would need an internet connection. And then, you know, I would get sucked into stuff. Time. We just need more time.
How many times a day do you pick up your phone thinking, right, I'm going to go and look up this specific thing. And as you pick it up, there's a notification. And you're like, oh, I'll just answer that. And then 10 minutes later,
you completely forget what you were doing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Happens all the time.
All the time. All the time. Yeah. Oh, it is a very first world problem, but it is a very prevalent one, I think.
The struggle is real.